of what we talked about last time. So we introduced neural networks for supervised learning, and specifically some concepts that we saw the definitions of last time are weights, biases, and activation functions in neural networks. We also talked about how expressive these networks are. And then we started to talk about how we can actually learn something using these networks, so meaning how do we train them. And so the first concept that we touched on was that of introducing a cost function. And so today I want to continue with this discussion of how we train these neural networks or get them to learn something. So we'll talk about a few more points of training. First of all, learning algorithms such as gradient descent, but we'll talk about some more sophisticated methods as well. Then we'll talk about something called backpropagation. And then if we have time, we'll start talking about the idea of overfitting, which is important within when you're training neural networks, but also for other algorithms as well. And we'll continue that discussion next lecture. Any questions before I get into that? Start by talking quite generally about learning algorithms. So we use a learning algorithm in order to help us minimize a cost function. Now, we already saw gradient descent when we were talking about linear regression. Now, specifically, let's just talk about what it would look like to be using a learning algorithm for a neural network. So in this case, we would want to minimize our cost function with respect to all the weights and biases in every layer of our network. Because these are the parameters that we adjust during training with neural networks. So this means we're trying to search for a solution so that the derivative of my cost function with respect to every weight and the derivative with respect to every bias is zero, and that's for all indices I, J, and L. So this looks pretty similar to what we had with linear regression. We also wanted to minimize with respect to all of our linear coefficients. But with linear regression, we were able to find an exact solution. Whereas as neural networks get quite large, we can no longer find an exact solution. with linear regression in our tutorial, we studied a direct solution for the parameters that we can fit to in our algorithm, and we also studied gradient descent. For a neural network, for the systems that we're going to want to study, we're going to have to resort to an algorithm such as gradient descent. We don't have an exact solution. And so this is what we want to solve with a neural network. We want to optimize with respect to weights and biases, but just because these learning algorithms I want to talk about are actually not specific to neural networks, I just want to give a slightly more general notation so that you see that these algorithms don't only apply to neural networks. So the notation I'm going to use is that we're minimizing C with respect to some big set of parameters, and I'm just going to index those parameters as P. And just to remind you, this cost function landscape can be very general, or it can be in very large dimensions, and so we can't visualize it completely, but you know, we could imagine it in if we just have two dimensions here. Maybe we have something like this, and then just kind of imagine in your mind that we're going to much higher dimensions, and so we have possibilities of getting stuck in local minima, and what we ultimately want to do is find the global minimum in this overall landscape. So let me just remind you very quickly of what would happen if we just use gradient descent. In this case, we keep taking steps. Where the steps size is proportional to the gradient of our cost function. Eta is a learning rate. Okay, so this is what we already kind of studied, and let's now look at some ways that we can alternatively take our steps, alternatives or improvements to this gradient descent. First thing we can talk about is something called stochastic gradient descent. So our cost function has a form where it can be decomposed into many pieces for each element of our data set. And now all the examples that we have seen do satisfy this. So So the idea here is that rather than calculating this entire cost function every time over my whole data set, I'm just going to look at a randomly chosen subset of my data. So rather than summing over my entire data set, I'm just going to sum over some mini batch of data that I can select at random. So in other words, I'm going to place my sum over my data set with just a sum over the mini batch when I want to calculate the gradients of my parameters and choose how to update my fitting parameters, my weights and biases in a neural network.
Yes.
Does that normally give us the cost function for gradients?
Sorry, say, ask that again?
I'm wondering.
If I was just using regular gradient descent, I would be summing over the entire data set. So I'm saying if it's stochastic gradient descent, you're summing over, rather than the whole data set, you're just summing over some subset of your data. Does that answer your question?
Where does the learning rate come from?
So the learning, yeah, that's a great question. So the learning rate is basically it's like a step, how big of a step I'm going to take when I update these parameters. So what we showed in the previous lecture where we talked about linear regression is that if this learning rate is small enough, then I'm going to be able to guarantee that my cost function decreases when I take this step. But if I take steps that are too small, then it can take me a very long time to find the actual solution that I want. So there's a lot of playing around we would have to do with what size we would want this to be. So far we've only talked about the case where this was a constant.
So it's a random step.
Yeah, it's a hyperparameter, yeah. Meaning like something that we set ahead of time. In a simple gradient descent algorithm, in the very simplest version of this, you would just choose a constant value for this eta beforehand, and then you would try to do your training and see what kind of a solution you could get. Then you might repeat it again with a higher or lower value and study how that affects the solution that you arrive at. Other questions? Okay, so just from hearing about this idea of stochastic gradient descent, does anyone have thoughts about why we might choose to do this over regular gradient descent? So just this idea of not summing over the whole data set, but just part of it. Why might we want to do that? Yeah, that's one thing for sure. Yeah, so it can be faster to calculate this cost function for sure. Oh, sorry.
And the gradient.
Other reasons you could think of? Do you remember we talked about how one thing you have to worry about when you have this kind of landscape is getting trapped in a local minima? So if we have just regular gradient descent, once we arrive at a local minimum, there's nothing in this algorithm that will get us out of it. So one benefit of this algorithm is that we have some randomness inserted here, so it can actually help us to get out of a local minimum that we might be stuck in. next. Let's talk about another idea that we can implement, which we can, you know, we can use a lot of these ideas all together. Another one we can, something else we can do is add momentum. So the idea here, we can think of this as keeping a memory of the previous gradients that we have. And so what that means, let me draw it here. So I'm gonna have a parameter, I'm gonna call it V, which every time I take a step, I'm gonna update that so that I consider its previous value and then also still consider a step like I do in gradient descent. And then my update to my parameters is going to be similar to before, except now I'm going to be having this V term, which kind of incorporates this previous memory of my gradient. So rather than just looking at the current landscape, I'm going to kind of have some history incorporated into this. So one takeaway that I hope you'll have from the study of neural networks in general is that there's a lot of hyperparameters in neural networks. And just now we've introduced another one called gamma. And we get back to just normal gradient descent if I choose that hyperparameter to be zero. Any thoughts on why this might be a good idea to do something like that? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I have like some, I can continue to change even if my gradients get small. It's going to help me to exactly what you're saying.
If it is a global minimum, then it doesn't matter how far you go back.
Right, you might have to go back and forth a few times, but yeah, the idea is that you'll hopefully eventually get there after some time.
Would it be beneficial to have a friction as well? Like, because if I have some momentum, then I'll just be oscillating freely in this potential.
So you're saying, how do I actually slow myself down?
Yeah, if I like reach a goal minimum, if I just have some potential events and momentum, without any sort of friction, energy's going to be the same.
Yeah, I guess this is, I mean, my answer is not going to be super rigorous, but this is all going to have to be controlled by how big this gamma is, right? Like, if your gamma is big, then you're somehow, like, taking more into account the history, so if you have some... So I'd say like here, you have some really long and steep tail here, so really steep gradient. So even when I'm here, okay, the gradient is small, but I'm going to take into account that it previously was steep, so I'm definitely going to want to keep going. Well, no, because you keep updating V, this V, right? So on one step, V is going to be updated like this, so you weight the previous value of V by some amount. Then the next step, you're going to reweight it. So two steps ago is going to be have a weight gamma squared now, right? And continue. So you're right. Like if this is too big, then yeah, you could maybe risk that you're going to overshoot it and your steps are no longer going to actually be taking steps in the right direction. You don't want this term to be way bigger than this one here. So that's why this hyperparameter adjustment can be really subtle. But I think kind of, again, another benefit, which is similar to that of stochastic gradient descent, is really this case where you think about a local minimum, where if I'm coming down here with regular gradient descent, I'm just going to get stuck. But again, the idea, a big benefit of this one is that it's going to remember, oh, I was updating parameters in this direction. So it's going to realize, okay, I should at least keep going this way. Of course, it doesn't guarantee you won't still get stuck in some way, but it can help you get out. It's another way to help you get out of these local minima. Ideally, as I said, this means that your parameters will keep changing, not just converge to a local minimum, even if your gradient is small. But of course, if you could, in principle, have a situation where V is also somehow small, well, then you can still be stuck. Okay, then there's a whole class of algorithms, which I'll just kind of mention, and we sort of alluded to them last time when we talked about linear regression. And this is the idea that your learning rate doesn't have to be something constant. So there's many different ways that we could adjust this learning rate data. And also, we might not want to take the same step size eta in all of the directions. So maybe for some weights, we want it to be bigger. For some biases, we want it to be smaller. So I'm just kind of glossing over the idea of this briefly, but let me just tell you the names of a few algorithms that adapt the learning rate, some of which we will use in tutorials and on homeworks, and you can read more about the details. One is an atom optimizer. So if you're interested, you can read about these. We're also going to just experiment with using them and see how they impact our results in tomorrow's tutorial. And let me just note that there are, of course, many other learning algorithms that exist. So in this class, we're going to use PyTorch for our programming. So if you want to see other examples of learning algorithms that are just already implemented in this library, you can look up this subcategory of functions, torch.optim. It's going to list a bunch of different learning algorithms that you can try out and read about. questions about learning algorithms? Okay, so let's then move on to the next point for today, which is backpropagation. Okay, so one important point to note. Is that our learning algorithms need to know the gradient of our cost function with respect to our weights and biases in order to decide how to update the parameters. And if we're talking about the very last layer of our neural network, so this is a capital L here, then my cost function is just directly dependent upon those values. Quite straightforwardly, but as I have to consider earlier layers, knowing these gradients is a little bit more subtle, as we're going to see. So my cost function directly depends on this output that I get from the very last layer. And so it's most straightforward to calculate those gradients for that layer as well.
I'm
going to walk through all of that, how the idea of how it works, and you're actually going to work out more of the details in the homework.
Okay.
So for now, the only point that I'm expecting to be super clear is this one, which is that the cost function actually depends on this output. So if you look at the cost functions, pardon? Yeah, so the feed-forward neural network, let me just draw one. You know, we have something like this, right? A bunch of layers, and I get some output at the end. Like this, right? So this is the output. This is this A from the last layer, and this is the output. I put in some input, it goes from left to right, and I get some output. And then what I do is I compare this output with the known label of my data set. So for example, I might take the difference and take the square. That's like the mean squared error that we've talked about before. There were other cost functions we could use, but all of the ones that we've seen depend on the output from this network, which means the output from the neurons at the very last layer.
And the outputs from previous layers is indirect.
Right, of course, it is for sure. So what comes out of here depends on what's here, but I'm just saying when you look at the formula for the cost function, you right away can see that it depends here. So what we'll see is that we're going to calculate the earlier gradients from the last gradients, and I'm going to walk through how that works. But yeah, for now, all you need to remember is that the cost function, when you look at those formulas, it directly depends on this output. Thank you. here I'm just writing what I already said, is that we're going to start from the very last layer, and we're going to see that we compute the gradients at a layer L based on those that are at a layer 1 ahead of it. And just to remind you again, my cost function is going to be a sum over my data set of little pieces. So, and if I'm using stochastic gradient descent, I might sum over a mini batch. So just to be super explicit, I'm actually going to show you how to calculate the gradients with respect to these small c's, and then we just do a sum over my data set or my or the mini batch in order to get the full thing. And I'm just realizing you probably can't see this, so let me move this higher. Okay, and then, you know, I don't want to know this gradient just for one training sample, so after I calculate those, I'm going to have to average over many samples in order to get my total estimate for the gradient of my cost function. Okay, so now let me just remind you of some notation from last lecture, which we introduced when we were talking about how information propagates through neural networks. So we said the output from a layer L for one of the neurons J comes from an activation function, which we call G. And the input to that function, we're going to call it Z. And what Z really is it looks at the output from the previous layer and it multiplies by some weights and it adds some biases. And now let me introduce some new notation. So this is how I take the gradient of the cost function for one sample with respect to Z. And of course, what we ultimately want is this gradient with respect to the weights and biases. But this is one useful parameter to introduce. So again, we assume this cost function is written as a function of the last layer's output. So we're going to start by computing this delta parameter for the last layer. And I can just write this simply like this. Okay, so again, everything so far is just in terms of these delta parameters. And I'm starting by looking at that delta parameter for the last layer. I'm going to call this equation 1. And now, I'm going to just kind of show you the results of what you get for other layers, and this is a calculation that you'll go through on the homework assignment. Feel free to ask any questions while I'm erasing the board if you have any. Okay, and then something similar for my earlier layers, I can again calculate this delta. Okay, and now finally I have an expression that's actually what I want for the gradient with respect to the weight. And the bias. And so this is how we're going to calculate the gradients that we need in terms of these delta parameters. And this is just going to be a little exercise that you'll do on the first homework. I'm gonna change boards because I want a full board for the next thing. Are there any questions about this backpropagation idea? Okay, so we've talked about a lot of pieces of information about neural networks over the last lecture and today. So let me just put it all together and write for you on the board just what it really means to train these networks, all the steps that you would have to do, so kind of some pseudocode. Term that we use when we're talking about training is often an epoch, so we have to train for several epochs, it's kind of a measurement of time. And so we have to do many epochs to do this. Let me show you what it means to train for one epoch. So I'm going to show this for just the most straightforward gradient descent algorithm, where we consider every single x in our data set, but I'll kind of point out along the way where you would make modifications if you were using a different learning algorithm. So first what I need to do is find the output from my network. And so for this, information has to propagate from left to right. So I'm gonna start with my input, which is just some x data point for one element of my data set. And I'm going to calculate the output from each layer using my activation functions and the current values that I have for my weights and biases. Then This is a forward pass of information. And I'm calling it that because to emphasize that the information is going from left to right. Then I can calculate this delta parameter for the very last layer of my network. And then I have to propagate backwards. Okay, sorry, I had to write this a bit small, but so then I'm gonna propagate backwards through my layers and I'm gonna get this delta parameter for every layer. And then I'm gonna use, that's from equation 2, then I'll use equations 3 and 4 to get the gradients of my cost function with respect to my weights and biases. So this step is backpropagation. And then after I've done that, then I need to actually calculate the total cost functions and actually update my parameters. So then this last step is just implementing gradient descent. And of course, you don't have to just do gradient descent, that's just what I'm writing because it's the simplest to write down, but you can use one of the alternatives to gradient descent and replace some of this here. Any questions about that? About kind of the idea of neural networks, how they're designed, how you train them? Anything? Okay. I'm going to go to the screen now for just a few minutes. Feel free to ask more questions as I set that up. So now I just want to get into starting the discussion for the concepts of overfitting, and what I'm showing you now, the slides today are going to be just more general than neural networks, just the idea of overfitting in general. And in tomorrow's lecture, we'll talk a bit more about this as a general concept and also specific things that you should watch out for regarding overfitting in neural networks. So let me first just show you a small segment of code, which is used to generate some data. So I'm going to have 10 data points. That's this n train is 10. My x is just going to be some linearly spaced data points between 0 and 1. And then my y is going to be just a linear function of this x, but with some random noise added to it. Okay, so we know this is the data, but let's now pretend that we give this to somebody and we don't tell them that it came from this linear function plus noise. And then this second person is going to fit some different polynomials to it. One that's a linear polynomial, one that has up to degree 3, and one that has up to degree 10. So the first one has two parameters it can fit for the linear coefficient and the slope. This one's going to have 4 parameters it can fit, and this one will have 11. So what do you think will happen as I try to fit this data set to these different models? And which model is actually going to give the what you might call the best fit or the lowest error on this training data?
Is going to be an overfit.
Yeah.
One won't have enough information and 3 will probably be fine.
Right. Although one probably, it might not necessarily have enough information, but it's actually most representative of the data that I started with, right? So here you can see the results that we have. So I should have actually output what coefficient it gets for the linear one. That would have been nice to add. I could do that next time. But definitely you can see the polynomial function with 11 free parameters. It goes through every data point, but it's you could see by looking at this that it's overfitting the data, right? Like this is, it's fitting things that are just totally even out of the range, like way above and way below. So I definitely, you know, you looking at this by eye, I think you can immediately say that this red curve isn't the right one that I would ideally want to fit here. But if I actually calculate the error, so the difference in the prediction versus the known label for all of these blue points, what's going to be the error for this red curve for just that training data? Do you see what I mean? If I calculate what this red curve...
Yeah, the error would be, I guess, zero for the past three.
Right. Yeah, so for the orange curve, which is like, well, I don't know, it's, I guess it's debatable in this case which one is actually better, the orange or the green, because it depends on what coefficient I got here. But even though these ones, definitely by eye, we can tell, they're better representation of the data, if I were to just calculate the error on my training data, I would see that, I would say then, if that was my measure of success, that the red curve was best because it has the lowest error. So often when we're looking at these learning algorithms, we start by looking at how they perform on our training data. But because of reasons such as this, we see that we actually have to look at data outside of what we've trained on in order to really have a good sense of how we're performing. So let me now ask you what might happen if I take that. Let me say you have the exact same models that were trained on that training data. And now I generate some new data, some testing data, which is generated in the very same way. So I'm choosing some x coordinates randomly between 0 and 1. And again, I'm generating the y coordinates by some linear model, again, with the same kind of noise. So now, which model would you say is going to make the best predictions for this data, if it's the models that were trained on the training data?
Linear model?
Right. Probably the linear model, and in any case, definitely not the red model, right? Now, these blue curves are now this new randomly generated data. So you can see here, for example, it's going to have a huge error between what the actual value is and what it predicts. It's not even on the screen because it's so far away. Of course, in some cases, it happens to do pretty well. But for most cases, it's going to be very bad. And probably the linear model is what's going to actually do best in this case for looking at this data. And so then the other question, how would this effect change if you repeat this whole experiment, again, fitting to the same linear third order and 10th order polynomials, but with many more data points? Let's say instead of 10 data points, I start out with 1,000 data points. How do you think this would affect the results of this experiment? Would I get the same thing? Would the type of curve I predict, this red one, would you think it would be the same if I had more data points?
I think it'd probably be more tame. Like it would try to hit more. It would probably not be as crazy.
Yeah. Exactly. So as you train on more and more data, you would expect that these effects would be improved. So. Even though, at the end of the day, even though we're pretending we didn't know this, our data came from just a very simple linear model, and a 10th order polynomial is maybe too complicated to be representing that, but if we have enough data, it should kind of be okay to do that. So if one way we can fix overfitting is to have more data points, but of course, we don't always have access to more data. And so, since we're a bit over time, let me just kind of highlight this section of this paper, section 2. It kind of walks you through this idea of why machine learning is difficult with some of these really simple fitting examples. That code that I showed you was actually taken from a notebook they created for this nice review paper. And I won't spend too much time on this. We can come back to this tomorrow. But let me just tell you some of the lessons, which I think are really nice, that they say. So first, we need to remember fitting is not predicting. So we saw this here. So if we fit on just some training data, it doesn't mean that we're going to be able to make good predictions for other data. This is maybe obvious in this example that I illustrated, but when we're looking at data sets where we can't visualize everything as easily, it's a lesson we really need to remind ourselves of. Again, we're sometimes tempted to use a really complicated neural network, for example, with many, many parameters because it's so expressible. It can express many different functions. But using a complex model can often result in overfitting. If we increase the complexity, we'll get better performance on our training data, but that's not necessarily what we want. What we really want is to be able to generalize to other data sets. So we can guard against overfitting by using a more simple model that doesn't have as many parameters, for example. We can also try to collect more data and train on bigger data sets. So these are kind of two strategies there, which again, we're going to talk about in a lot more detail in the next lecture. And then one other point, which is cut off here, is just that to just remember it's also difficult to generalize beyond situations that are encountered in training data. So you want to make sure, or you want to try to ensure that your training data represents what you actually want to be using it for in your generalization case. So for example, in these examples I showed you, we trained on the range where x was 0 to 1. Even if you had a really great model, for example, if you had tons and tons of data points, it might do really well if you train it on a 10th order polynomial on 1,000 data points within that range. But then as soon as you look outside of the range it's trained on, you shouldn't expect it to do well anymore. So just be aware that if there's something you're looking for that isn't represented in your training data, you can have problems as well. So again, this is just kind of foreshadowing what we're going to talk about in more detail in the next lecture. Any questions on that? Okay, thanks, and see you tomorrow.